my song. Let's sing it. It's gonna be freaking awesome. Come on, it's gonna be freaking awesome. You know the words. It's gonna be freaking awesome. That's it, say. It's gonna be freaking awesome.
Hey everybody, yeah. Welcome back. It's Jesse Blaze Snyder, the coolest geek alive. It's Wednesday, and I got another awesome episode for you. Last time, we started talking about my personal experience working for Marvel, DC, Disney, Pixar, The Muppets, and more, and all the various ways how comics broke me, but also how I built myself back up at various times and again recently with the campaign that I'm doing right now on Kickstarter for King of Kings, which guess what, guys? We made our initial raise. We're at like $5,500 and something dollars or something like that. Thank you guys so much. Our initial goal was $5,000, and we already did it because of people like you. I so appreciate it. I will say we still need more help. That $5,000 raise is just to get the book printed and made, but you know we have more things to raise, more stretch goals, and cool things to unlock, and it's all in the name of producing the rest of the series, finishing it off. This is a four-issue miniseries starring the gods of all the religions of the world in a giant battle of the bands to determine the reigning ideology of the day. It's hysterical. It's a bit blasphemous, but it's there for fun. It's there to make you laugh. We're not trying to piss anybody off. If you think you're going to be pissed off, please don't read it. I'm not trying to piss you off. It's really just there to provoke thought and there to give a little bit of an even keel for all of the different religions, because I think sometimes people put their own religion at the top of the heap and they don't recognize that the other thoughts of the other human beings around them on planet Earth are equally valuable and need to be respected equally. So, that's really what we're doing here. We're respecting everybody equally. We're making fun of everybody equally. And we've just got an amazing four-issue miniseries to complete. But right now, this first Kickstarter is just for issue number one, which is all done and ready to go. Just needs to be printed. And if you help us get through our stretch goals, there's tons of cool things to unlock to upgrade the book and digital perks, and it's amazing. So if you're interested in supporting me, supporting my compatriots in this effort to make independent comic books, to build my company, Killer Rabbits Company, which makes comic books and really wants to help make a better world filled with more wonderful creative projects that are held to a high standard, that make you think, that make you happy. That's really the goal of me and my company, is just to make millions of people happy. No, not millions of people. Billions of people. Let's make billions of people happy. So please, come help me in that endeavor. Go check out King of Kings on Kickstarter right now or when this show's done. But anyway, I want to get back to talking about my personal journey with comics and, you know, as a professional. Last time, I spoke about how my first real disappointment was when I had my Hulk comic and my Deadpool short, how they both got delayed for years, and I ended up having a Strangeland comic book that I wrote for Fangoria come out before my work at Marvel, which is what I got paid for first. So my Marvel experience was really disappointing. I think they were the company that I wanted to work for the most. That's why I went after them. And man, after a few years of pitching Marvel, I was just done, or at least done for now, because I wasn't being respected as this great writer that needed to be hired. I was a new up-and-coming guy, and a lot of times I was getting handed off or passed around or having to wait. And the last straw was a pitch that I did for Blade. I don't know if you're a fan of Wesley Snipes' Blade films, but I love those movies. I wasn't as big of a Blade fan in the comics. Blade in the comics had always played up the magical, kind of supernatural part of vampirism. A lot of the magic concepts in Marvel Comics didn't really exactly work for me, and I think they haven't exactly worked for the audience. If you look at sales over time, a book like Doctor Strange, Ghost Rider, and The Darkhold, or whatever it might be, any of these magic-oriented offshoots of Marvel Comics, they've not lit the sales charts on fire in general compared to the other things. And part of the reason why that is because Marvel gets by on being the world outside your window. And a lot of the ways it is the world outside your window is it's a science fiction-based world. It's a world where people's genetics are changing and they become mutants with powers, or somebody gets irradiated in space or on a testing field and they become the Hulk or the Fantastic Four. Science fiction drives 99.9% of the greatest of all the Marvel stories. And that was a huge opportunity that was just waiting to be capitalized on. It's still waiting to be capitalized on by Marvel Comics after the Blade films came out. Because the really cool thing about the Blade films, which hadn't really been explored at the time, as far as I remember, in any vampire films on screen, Blade depicted a science fiction version of vampires, where they were really handling it scientifically. And science fiction vampires work great in the Marvel Universe. At the time, Blade didn't have any series. He wasn't appearing anywhere. And I was pretty savvy. I was recognizing that Marvel was constantly looking to dust off characters that weren't being utilized. So I saw that Blade had been absent and there was things to do with him. So I came up with this really great pitch. I actually wrote the first issue. I had to reinvent a replacement character for Whistler because that dynamic of the Alfred Batman to the Whistler Blade, that was a really good dynamic. But you couldn't use Whistler because he was owned by New Line Cinema, who had produced the film. So I created a character named Hummer, which was kind of like a little sex joke, and he was from the military, and he couldn't walk, or he had no legs. I forget if he was an amputee or something. He was Blade's guy in the chair, and it was a really nice dynamic. I also really slid Blade straight into the Marvel Universe. I had him do this amazing attack in broad daylight in New York City, where he set fire to all of these skyscrapers that were home to vampires. But the mainstream people, the normies, Captain America and other people, they didn't know that those were vampires. They thought that Blade created this terrorist attack on the city and he becomes the most wanted man alive. There's also a really cool alternative version of a Daywalker, this vampire, I think his name was Pitch, and he had skin that was so black that it protected him from the sun. So he was effectively a daywalker because he was so dark-skinned, so much melanin in his skin or whatever it was. He had a special skin disorder. I was also introducing the Nosferatu, based, of course, on Nosferatu, that basically Blade activates and they come over to go after him. And one day, maybe it'll happen, but I swear, I put so much into this book. The pitch was called Blade and the Daystalkers. And on the front of the pitch, it featured a quote from Hannibal King, which said, "What sort of idiots stalk vampires at night?" Because originally, there was a team called the Night Stalkers that Blade was a part of with Hannibal King. And when I was working on my pitch, I was just like, it's really the stupidest thing ever to go out at night to hunt vampires. Like, you should really go during the day, find them where they're sleeping, stake them, move on with our lives. And that was the kind of practical approach that I was taking to this book that I thought Blade would be taking, and I thought really fit the character and made it all work. Well, I think it was Mark Benicci, who was the editor of the Hulk office at the time, who I'd gotten connected to because of the Hulk one shot that I did. And I was able to submit that script to them, and their office loved it. I mean, I got compliments at the time, which, you know, ended up not mattering at all. And it kind of made me more mad that they said this. But they said, this is one of the best pitches we've ever received. And I was like, oh my God, you know, again, another thing of like, I was so excited. I did it. I kept thinking I did it along the way here. You know, just it was Axel Alonso all over again. Okay, I didn't get my Punishers in, but I did it. I'm doing Blade. And then it took 8 months for them to pass my Blade pitch and my first issue script to the executives at Marvel. And by the time they did, it was too late. It was too late. Another project with Blade had already been greenlit. And it's not a good one. It's a terrible, stupid, wasteful idea where they pulled Blade into the X-Men universe. I think it's basically completely forgotten by most of the people who read X-Men comics because it was such like a out of left field. Why are we doing mutants and the vampires? Like, what is this? It was just a really strange book that was not remotely the respect that Blade needed, because Blade being teamed up with the X-Men was essentially saying, we don't believe in Blade. That was a mistake, man. They needed to have Blade number one and have it mean something. That's what Marvel needed to do. Blade and the X-Men just seemed like, oh man, they really don't believe in Blade and they're not really sure what to do with him, so they're just teaming him up with their most popular book, the X-Men. And that was a terrible idea. It was a terrible idea. And that beat me to the punch. That terrible idea got through first and was greenlit first. So by the time they got my really good pitch for a Blade solo book, it was all over. It was done. I couldn't be approved. Work was already being done. And this only happened because they didn't pass it on to the proper people for 8 months. They waited until this creative retreat. And at the creative retreat, they brought it up instead of passing it along at the time when I had written it, when it was fresh, when it was useful, when Blade hadn't been on the stands for forever, and it was ready to go. But they didn't. And I didn't get the job. And I was just so devastated. I just kind of went, I can't do this anymore. I want to work for Marvel so badly. But if they keep doing this to me, and it just kept different things in different ways, how many years? It took years for my first two professional works that I did with Marvel to come out. Years. My Toy Story, which I'm going to get to in a little bit, that came out before the Hulk one-shot. The Hulk one-shot came out while my Toy Story ongoing series was coming out, and this was by the time I was fed up with Marvel, and I'm like, you know what? They're going to come crawling back to me, and they're going to hire me because of all the great work I go do for other people, because I can't stand this. They're not appreciating the great work that I keep submitting to them, and I'm not getting like pushed to the top of the list or getting any sort of special treatment or attention. I'm just some guy pitching stories, and I can't take this anymore. Continuing on from there, I had gone to a convention and I was going around and I was actually buying some things in celebration of my issue of Marvel Comics Presents. There was a poster that J. Scott Campbell had drawn. It was a wraparound cover for the Marvel Comics Presents volume that I had been in. And Deadpool was on that cover, on that poster, because of my story. So I bought that poster and I bought myself a little something. I forget what it was, but I was walking around the convention and I run into Dan DiDio, who was then the editor-in-chief of DC Comics. So I knew exactly who Dan DiDio was. And I also kind of knew Dan through my friend Dane Hall. Rest in peace. Love you, Dane. Dane was a television producer. He was actually a friend of my family. He was a big geek. They met Dane and they were like, oh man, you'd love my son Jesse. You guys should meet. And then me and Dane met and we were like, yeah man, let's do something. Let's produce something together. We love comics. We're real geeks. And we were working on a show called The Geek Nation for a long time, which was supposed to be like an Entertainment Tonight for geek culture entertainment, where there's Lord of the Rings. And I mean, very much what I do here was what me and Dane Hall were talking about doing with Geek Nation over 20 years ago. I mean, you see the theme with all these geek things. Geek, 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 coolest geek alive, geek, geek, geek. Here I am on the Geek Nation host. That was what I was going to do. And me and Dane were working on that for a very long time. It just so happened that Dane got cancer and he actually died within like 2 months of getting his cancer. And he and I, we would talk like every few months. And I literally just didn't hear from him. And then all of a sudden, I found out one day that he had passed away. So rest in peace, Dane Hall. He was a great guy, fellow geek like us. Would have been great if we could have done that show together. It was very, very, very sad that we weren't able to. But because of Dane, I knew a little bit more about Dan DiDio, because Dane Hall produced the Home Shopping Network segments with Dan DiDio, where they were both working in television at the time on the Home Shopping Network, and the two of them were responsible for huge sales of these limited run, well, I don't know how limited they were, but these plastic wrapped Death of Superman covers, and they were selling this to the normies, mainstream, buy one for your grandkid, it's gonna be worth a lot in the future. So Dane Hall and Dan DiDio had a relationship. And when I saw Dan, I stopped him and I just said, hey, Dan, I'm Jesse Blaze Snyder. I'm friends with Dane Hall and blah, blah, blah. So we talked and he says, oh, I see you got all this Marvel stuff in your hand. And I go, oh, well, I just wrote my first story for Marvel Comics. I'm really excited. I got a character on this poster, all these things. And Dan goes, well, hey, man, what are you doing working for them? Why don't you come over and work for us? So I go, I'd love to work for you. Give me your email and I'll reach out. So Dan reaches out eventually. He kind of passes me on to another editor, Ian Sattler, who was like kind of his second in command at the time. And I am assigned to do a Batman or Superman inventory story. And inventory stories are designed to be evergreen, could be released at any time, something that they can hold on to for when they might need it. I came up with a lot of different ideas for Batman. I had one idea for Superman, which was pretty cool. I was going to do this thing where basically this crazy alien godlike intelligence comes to planet Earth, scans the planet, picks Superman out of the whole of planet Earth,
and makes him defend the Earth, like he's going to destroy the Earth unless Superman can convince him that the Earthlings are worth saving. I didn't write that one, but I ended up writing this great Batman one-shot, which I wrote as an April Fool's Day special because I thought it had the best likelihood of being published at some point in time, because who doesn't want to read a Batman April Fool's Day special starring the Joker? I'm a huge Mark Hamill fan, and I just have that Joker voice of his in my head from the Batman animated series, and I swung for the fences, and I wrote the greatest Batman one-shot that I was capable of writing. And they loved it. They really did love it. It did get drawn immediately. It was actually drawn by one of the people who had worked on this DC book called Countdown, which was a terrible book when largely a lot of the artists were not ready for prime time and wasn't very good. It was a weekly book they were putting out, and a lot of the art was weak. So I didn't expect anything from the art in my one shot of one of these artists, but somebody told him he was drawing a Batman comic, and holy crap, man, the thing that he drew, it's like a Brian Bolland kind of Batman comic. It's beautiful, and it is still just sitting in the hard drives at DC Comics to this day, never having been published. It's such a bummer. But doing that audition for that Batman script led me to getting asked by DC to create a vampire romance comic book for them. At the time, Twilight was coming out. It was very popular. And they were like, we got to capitalize on this. And they went, hey, let's go get Dee Snider's son, who's also a musician. And he's a cute guy. And he can be the guy. And all the girls and all the people, they'll like the romantic comic book that he writes. This was a terrible idea. Okay. I'm a geek. And I'm telling you, no geek culture comic book loving reader was looking for DC to make their own Twilight. So knowing this, I really worked hard to figure out how to deliver what they were asking me for in a way that might actually succeed, because I saw their pitch to me as, well, that's going to be an utter failure. Let me see if I can figure out a way to make this better. So I came up with an idea for a book called Dead Romeo. And the initial premise of the book and what eventually came out are night and day different from one another. And this was a terrible case where I learned sometimes you can't see the forest for the trees when you're in the middle of things and you keep getting notes from an editor and you're making changes. And before you know it, the series and the thing, it's not exactly anywhere close to what you had in mind, and on some levels it doesn't necessarily work the way it worked yesterday because they made you change and remove things that actually changed and removed the overall experience for the story, which is the case for my Dead Romeo thing. I remember meeting somebody years later and telling them what I'm about to tell you, who was a big fan of the Dead Romeo thing, and they were like, oh, I thought it was just like supposed to be like a fun horror comic book, gratuitous and violent, whatever. I didn't realize you had so much like depth that you were trying to put into it. And I went, oh yeah, man, I had some really cool stuff going on. Basically, the story of Dead Romeo is the story of Romeo and Juliet, except with vampires. This guy, Romeo, he's the lead singer of this 80s punk rock band called the Dead Romeos. And he gets turned into a vampire. He doesn't know he's a vampire. He's making out with his chick. The bloodlust comes over him. And before he knows it, he's killed her. Once he sees that he's killed the love of his life, he kills himself. So it was just like a simple premise. And this guy's in hell, but he's a good guy. He's a good guy, but he's in hell. He committed suicide and he killed the girl he loved. So he's trying to earn his way out of the pit because it's just misery and it's just torture. So he agrees to go to Earth and kill this girl. He doesn't know why he's supposed to kill her, but he's going to go kill this girl for them. And when he gets to the surface and they bring him back to life and he goes to do his mission, he meets her and he can't do it. He can't kill her. And hell says, well, that's not going to stand. So they send one sinner from each of the rings of hell to go and kill him and her. And this was the cool premise of the story for people who were fans of DC Comics, because the nine sinners were nine sinners from the DC universe. People like Manchester Black, who was dead at the time, Lobo, who was dead at the time, Jonah Hex, and I'm forgetting some of the characters, but a whole bunch of characters that I knew people would love to see, that I wanted to see. And I put this whole book together in this pitch, and it was based loosely on Dante's Inferno. Lobo was like the real big bad at the tip of the thing. Lobo was in the ninth ring of hell, treachery, because he killed his entire race. There's nothing more treacherous than that. When Ian Sattler and Dan DiDio got my pitch for this book, they came back to me and they asked me to basically scale it down back to just vampires, which I knew was not going to cut the mustard with fans. But they hung something over my head. They said, hey, look, we love this premise with the, you know, Dante's Inferno and all this stuff. Could you come back and write us a Lobo miniseries with this premise after we put out Dead Romeo? And Lobo is one of my favorite characters at DC Comics. I love Lobo. Lobo's over the top and just really, there's a lot of fun things to do with Lobo. If you've never read the Alan Grant, Simon Bisley first Lobo series and Lobo's back and the paramilitary special, oh my God. Lobo is super, super fun. In fact, that should be homework for tonight. Go find that Alan Grant, Simon Bisley first Lobo miniseries. Buy the trade paperback. You won't regret it. So I was just, as a fan, I was like, okay, I'll write a Lobo series. You know, I'll figure it out. Of course, I never actually got to write this Lobo series, and all I did was make the Dead Romeo series much worse because of these notes and these promises, but I digress. So I have to excise all of these characters that I made. They even actually made, they made me recast Lobo and recast Jonah Hex and recast Manchester Black. So I rewrite the pitch and change all the characters so that it's nobody that anybody will recognize, which again, I think is a big mistake. I think you can get people to read the book if there are these dead characters coming back in this whole scenario, because the whole reason why Romeo was supposed to be coming from hell was because they had done a series just recently where they had revealed that there were vampires in hell. There'd been this look at hell. I forgot what the series was called, but they were like, we showed vampires in hell, and then we're going to have vampire romance. And I was like, all right, well, I don't know how much this works, but I'll give it my best to see if I can do what you guys want me to do. I told you before, most of the creative edicts come from the non-creative people in editorial, in production. These people aren't writing the scripts, but they will give you their terrible ideas. Granted, there are exceptions to every rule, and sometimes there are editors who are as brilliant, if not more brilliant, than the creators that they work with. But oftentimes, the people who are assigning you story ideas are not the people who should be coming up with the story ideas. I promise you. Now, I did my absolute best, but at the end of the day, I could not save this shitty premise. Especially not after editorial rewrote the copy that I had written for the Previews magazine. For those of you who read comics, you'll know about Previews magazine. Previews magazine is this big old book of all of the comic books that are coming out every month, all of the toys and other things that comic book stores and direct market shops can order from. They'd asked me to write the promotional copy for Dead Romeo, and I was very careful to not make it about the fact that Romeo was a rock star and all these different things, because it sounded too much like Lestat and other things. My premise was very different than Lestat and so much of these other things that had come out, but at a glance, it would seem like that. And I was very careful not to make it sound like it was Twilight, because I knew the direct market would not order the book. These idiots were like, but yeah, Twilight's really popular. Yeah, really popular, but not popular in comic book stores. Maybe you could get that into the bookstores later, but as individual comic books, this needed to appeal to the direct market. And after they made me remove all the great, dead, famous DC characters, and after they made me bring it down, boil it down to just vampires versus vampires, it became fairly generic. I mean, it's a fun book. If you go read it, it is action-packed. I certainly have some good page turns in there. There's art from Ryan Benjamin, which, you know, honestly, I love Ryan Benjamin. Ryan, shout out. But Ryan's a pro. He's been in the business a long time. And sometimes Ryan is basically making choices based on how much he's getting paid, how prestigious the project is, and other things. And for Ryan, this wasn't a particularly prestigious project. He didn't really care about it. And when I met him at San Diego Comic-Con, he revealed to me that he had rushed to finish the sixth issue of our book in like 3 or 4 days so he could be ready for San Diego Comic-Con. And like, this was just like little, some anecdote he was saying to me, like it was no big deal. I was devastated to hear that. What? You rushed to finish? This is my first published book from DC Comics, and my artist is rushing to finish it in 3 days? I was devastated. I've never said that to Ryan. He might find out one day. I mean, I really like Ryan. Ryan's a really good dude. He and I get along well. He's an athletic guy. I'm an athletic guy. You know, we have a lot of similar interests. And, you know, and I've worked with him at other times since and hung out with him. And he's a good dude. And he does great work. The covers for Dead Romeo are mind-blowing. If you look at the covers for Dead Romeo and then look at the interiors for Dead Romeo, you'd be like, wait, this is the same guy? And you're not silly to think that. It's night and day, his interiors and those covers. It was really disappointing having that book come out, having people kind of reject it because it was Twilight in comic book form. I knew that that was a bad idea. I did everything that I could to try to work against this terrible premise for DC Comics to try to save them from themselves, and they kept stopping me. They kept stopping me from saving them from what they were doing. And in the end, it just was a flash in the pan, little vampire miniseries that they put out that really went nowhere. The book has some fans, thank God. There's plenty of people who came away from it just appreciating it for what it was. You know, I got some cute and sweet, snappy dialogue and some funny moments and some decent characters, and it's a fun book. But it's not what it was meant to be, which was a masterpiece. Every single thing that I've ever tried to write for any of these companies, my goal has been masterpiece. Masterpiece level, go. That's what I want. That's what I always want to achieve. And if I'm not achieving that, then I am devastated, disappointed, and that's it. So at DC Comics, basically, the exact same thing that happened to me at Marvel Comics happened. At DC, it took a little bit longer because I kept getting these opportunities that seemed like they were going to go somewhere. One of my good friends, Michael Martz, was working over there, and we had a great pitch for Haley's Circus featuring Deadman. And this was actually, I'm probably going a little out of order from some of these things I'm going to talk about, because this was later on when Scott Snyder had written something where they had killed Haley's Circus. And we were going to bring back Haley's Circus and bring back Deadman and make Deadman a zombie. Deadman's character, traditionally, he can possess people, but he doesn't appear in his own book because he's dead. He's just a disembodied ghost. So the new premise was that now Deadman can possess his own corpse, and therefore he can be a character in his own book, and he gets to be a better version of himself, zombie Deadman, who can physically interact in the world. It's lame when there's a Batman-Deadman crossover, and Batman's teamed up with some dude wearing a sweater because Deadman's taken possession of his body. But it doesn't look like Deadman. It's not Batman and Deadman visually. It's Batman and this guy that he took possession of. So being able to make Deadman a physical character in his own book is really novel and a great idea. They should still do that at DC. And I'd be happy if I saw anybody do that idea. Somewhere along the way, there was a pitch that I made for a character named Lockup, who was from the Batman animated series, and I had a premise where he was going to get arrested, and he was going to still be acting as a vigilante from prison, investigating everybody's crimes, and if he decides you're guilty, he'll kill you in prison, he'll put you on trial in prison. That was a fun little one, but it didn't go anywhere. It was for a certain, I guess it was for like a series of one-shots of these Batman villains, and there was like two or three rounds that I was supposed to be in, but the higher up editors kept handing down to the editors that I was working with who was going to write all of the books. So even though he had chosen people to write the books, he had to go call those people and say, oh, I'm sorry. Sorry, Jesse. You're not going to be my guy because they told me I have to use Steve. Whoever Steve is. I was pitching for a Vertigo horror anthology with an editor who I adore, Sarah Litt. Shout out to Sarah Litt. And unfortunately, same thing happened. Sarah got from on high. Oh, sorry. Karen Berger says that I need to use this person and this person and this person and this person. No good. Next up, I had Ethan Van Sciver, who was one of my favorite comic book artists. For those of you who get triggered by hearing that dude's name, what a silly time that we're living in. Let me say, once and for all time, I've met Ethan Van Sciver. He's been very, very kind to me and very cool to me, just as cool and kind to me as, let's say, Mark Waid or anybody else. He is most certainly not a racist. The idea that he is a racist that has been propagated by the industry and the way that he has been rejected and ostracized, I find despicable, because these other comic book creators like me, they know that he is not a racist. This is just some silly political pissing contest. And they have effectively canceled Ethan Van Sciver and other people from mainstream comics basically just from not kissing the ring. Ethan would not kiss the ring, and he's a little bit of a dick. I will tell you that. He's got like a, you know, a joking personality where he's got a sense of humor, but he's biting and he's not afraid to say what's on his mind. That does not a racist or sexist make. There are just people in this world who don't kiss rings. I don't kiss rings. Ethan and other artists and writers blacklisting from the industry was completely political ideology motivated, and none of these people from Chuck Dixon on down are bad people, and it is not fair what has happened to them. Just because you come from a different place and have different ideas about how we should move forward in the world does not mean that you deserve to have your livelihood taken away from you for all time, and does not mean that you deserve to be harassed and shouted down as a racist or sexist. This is just hyperbole taken to an insane, insane place. And I cannot wait until the industry comes to its collective senses and comes back together as one. There shouldn't be a left side of the industry and a right side of the industry. It should just be one industry like it was 10 years ago. The worst part about it is mainstream comics lost some of its greatest talents over stupid political arguments that don't matter to the creative process of creating these things. Chuck Dixon's politics as a Republican never entered into the pages of Robin or Nightwing or any of my other favorite books that he wrote. It's just so disappointing. So that in mind, I will never denounce this man, because Ethan heard I was getting work, saw some of my things, and he was encouraging, and he even said, hey, let's do something together. Would you want to write a pitch for me? And I, yeah, yes, yes, yes. He was one of the greatest DC comic book artists at the time at the company, and he was letting me pitch him something. So I owe this man for encouraging me and giving me the time of day when he never had to. And this one, I take on the chin. This was my fault why this didn't happen. I had this great Batman story. It was meant to be a love letter to a series called Venom, or a mini series that was in the Legends of the Dark Knight that was written by, I think it was Denny O'Neill, which was the origin of the steroid that Bane uses. Batman started using it for a little while. He gets addicted to the steroids and he has to lock himself in a portion of the Batcave to go through withdrawal and get over this thing. And it was Batman learning how to be the Batman that we know and love today. And that was so cool and appealing to me. But Ethan Van Sciver wanted to tell a story of today's Batman. But I felt like the best Batman idea that I currently had in my hands was this Batman Year 3 story that I wanted to write on deck. I had some ideas, but I knew that this story was really, really good. And I stupidly thought maybe I could somehow make it a modern day Batman story, even though Batman's a bit less than perfect and he's learning all about fire. Well, when Ethan read my pitch, he was like, this isn't Batman. Batman knows how to fight fire. He's been doing this for years. And he was right. He was right. I was trying to write an old school Batman Year 4 story, you know, something where Batman was still learning. And he wanted me to write a modern day Batman tale. And the pitch that I gave him was not it. So Ethan rejected. He was like, nah, I don't like this. That was on me. I wish I was smarter at the time and had seen what I was doing so that I could have come up with the right thing for Ethan. I'm sure I could have if I just put a little bit more into it. I was just so smitten at the time with this idea for my Batman learning about fire story, which was going to be, it was really a story to lift up Firefly, who I thought was a great underutilized character, and Dr. Phosphorus, who I thought was another great and underutilized character. It would have been awesome if I could have got him to do the Batman Year 3, Year 4 version of the story, but because he wanted to do something modern, it just didn't work. Continuing at DC, Scott Snyder, who I don't know if I've talked about this before, but Scott Snyder, who's one of the biggest comic book writers out there now, not to be confused with Zack Snyder, the director, Scott was, he's from Long Island, Me and him were going to the same comic book store, and we came up together. When his Iron Man Noir series came out, which was one of his first things he ever published, My Marvel Comics Presents came out, and Toy Story, and all these things. Everything was coming out around the same time. So he watched me rise as I watched him rise even further, way further than me. And we'd never met, but we'd heard about each other a lot at the comic store. So one day I was at a convention, and Scott sweetly just came up to me and went, "Hey, I'm Scott, and you know, I know about you and whatnot from Fourth World Comics, and I just wanted to say hi and how you doing," and he and I were chatting, and before you knew it, he offered to try to get me into DC, specifically in the Bat office, which was where I wanted to be, and he was well established at DC by that time, so I got really excited, and I started writing all these pitches. I wrote a pitch called Homicide Squad, which is Task Force Y. Task Force Y was all of these killers who were dead, who they had brought back to life. It was essentially a vehicle for Hitman and some of these other characters who had been killed in the DC Universe in these like assassin books, who were very cool, badass assassins, and I was bringing all of them back to this Homicide Squad team. Ugh. It was a great pitch. I wanted to do that one so bad. I also had a book called Wildcats, which was about the Ted Grant Wildcat from the JSA trying to train his son, who was the werecat version of him, where he actually turns into a werewolf cat, training him to be a champion UFC fighter. So his coach was the original Wildcat, the champion boxer, and he was going into the UFC. And there was going to be things like stories about performance-enhancing drugs and metahumans in sports and a lot of cool stories there, a lot of cool pitches. It was about fathers and sons, about having a father who is an icon, who is a rock star, essentially. I know all about that. So this was another book that I was really excited to write. And then another one, Jonah Hex Gotham Bounty Hunter, which featured Jonah Hex brought to modern day Gotham City and basically operating as a Dog the Bounty Hunter kind of figure in Gotham, slowly collecting the modern day technologically advanced weapons of some of the bad guys, like he gets the freeze gun from Mr. Freeze and things like that. I was so excited to do that book. And there was even more, some really great pitches like a Dr. Midnight and Mr. Terrific series, tons of things that I was coming up with because I was so stoked that I had Mike Martz and all these other editors, and now I had Scott Snyder who was going to get me into DC. But somehow, it just never worked out. But it didn't matter because around that time, I got to meet my best friend, Aaron Sparrow. Aaron is a writer and an editor, and he is a writer's editor because he knows how to be supportive and helpful, but not get in the way, to be encouraging. He's just the most amazing man on planet Earth. Shout out to Aaron Sparrow. I love you, my friend. I love you so much. And we need more people like you in comics. We need more people like you in the entertainment field. If you've never read any of Aaron Sparrow's delicious Darkwing Duck, he has made Darkwing Duck with James Silvani. They've done, I don't know, well over 20 issues. They're great, 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 great books. Nowadays, I get to be one of his editors and his readers, so I usually get to see these things before they ever come out, and I get to hear about all the stuff that didn't get to come out, even though it was so great. And Aaron, man, he just does great stuff. So Aaron had been taken over by aliens. No, he had taken over the Boom Kids line at Boom Studios. Boom Studios owned the Disney license for Disney Pixar, The Muppets, and Disney Animation. I am the biggest Muppet fan on the planet. And I really believe that I understand why the Muppets work so well. And you know what? I'll even take the time to tell you why the Muppets work so well. If you're a creative person, you're insecure because you're constantly making things for other people and you aren't other people. So you're not exactly sure if the other people are going to read the things the same way they seem to be reading for you. Granted, generally speaking, they do. But there's always that fear that like, I don't know, is this going to be good? The Muppets are characters who are pursuing their dreams and they're awful at it. They are far worse at what they do than you will ever be. If you are a struggling comedian, you are not as bad as Fozzie Bear. You're not as bad as Fozzie. If you are a struggling musician, you are not as bad as the Electric Mayhem. You will finish your set. If you are some weird performance artist, you are not as bad as Gonzo, who's probably going to burn the whole place down by accident because he's out of his mind. The Swedish chef can't cook. Kermit is a frog running a variety show. These things make them the underdog to end all underdogs. The saying from Britain, "Oh, you Muppet! You're such a Muppet!" What does that mean? You're a Muppet. You just can't get it right. That is the appeal of the Muppets. They just can't get it right. They're pursuing their dreams. They really care about what they're pursuing, but they just can't seem to get it right. And the Muppets make creative people especially feel better about themselves. The Muppets are like a security blanket. No one will ever be as bad at their creative pursuits as the Muppets. But we can do a little better. We can use them to gain strength and feel better about what we're doing and know that what we're doing, well, it's not that bad. It's not that bad. So I'm a huge Muppet fan. I love them. And I go to Aaron, and Aaron's told this story many times before. I'm always very flattered when he does. But he said he was approached by dozens and dozens and dozens of people that day. And everybody kind of came up to him the same way, like, oh, you know, I'm a writer and I'd like some work. And then Jesse came up, me. And I said, hey, I love the Muppets, and I'm a writer, and I see that you guys have the license, and I've seen the Muppets be done poorly so often. People just don't exactly get them and why they work, and I really want to see somebody nail it for the fans like me who love them. And if you give me a chance on the Muppets, I will show you greatness, I promise. I just love it so much, and I know that I could replicate the magic that is there. And Aaron went, you're hired, but I don't have any Muppets to offer you. Maybe one day I can get you in on some Muppets. But in the meantime, what about Pixar's Toy Story? Now, I am one of the biggest Pixar fans on the planet. It's been so disappointing of late as Pixar has kind of fallen off a cliff for me because they're just not what they once were. But saying that, Toy Story was actually my least favorite of all the things that they had done because I felt like Toy Story was a ripoff of a great Jim Henson property called The Christmas Toy. If you've never watched The Christmas Toy, oh man, it's just so wonderful and slightly unsung. It essentially is just the story of a Christmas toy who gets replaced next Christmas by the new Christmas toy. And all the feelings and emotions that these toys have because they're feeling like they don't matter anymore. They're not loved anymore. It's a great story. And Toy Story has a lot of the same themes. So I was a little bit like slow to the party on becoming a big Toy Story fan. But of course, after I had been asked to pitch Toy Story, I really got into the property in a big way. And I pitched basically a story about toy variants, making a lot of jokes about variants, having a second action figure of Buzz Lightyear get bought for Andy, and Andy goes to return it to the store. But before he can, the Buzz Lightyear who came comes out of his package, beats up the old Buzz, and puts him into the package, so he gets returned instead because this toy had a bunch of trauma because he's already been returned a bunch of times. Because at this point, everybody already has a regular Buzz Lightyear, and he's not one of these great Buzz Lightyear variants that they've been putting out. So the toys have to take this Buzz back to the toy store so that they can get their Buzz, and they meet all of these variants, which were plays on the crazy variants that had been put out for lines like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Batman and whatever else. In the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles line, they literally had a caveman Leonardo figure. It was kind of a cool figure, but it was just like, what the hell is this? What are these toys? So me and Aaron, as it turned out, and this is why we've become such great friends, we're both huge toy guys and customizers. I had a custom city that I had built for my toys. He was customizing individual figures. So he and I were walking around a con one day, New York Comic Con, and we're like making all these references, noting all these toys. And like we turned to each other at some point and we were like, holy shit, you speak toy? And we're like, did we just become best friends? And that's it. It really, the rest is history. We've been best friends ever since. I think I've talked about I had a fire where I lost my entire toy collection. I had one of the biggest collections of individual characters in 6-inch scale and a city, and all my toys burnt down. I have hundreds of toys now, and 90% of them were purchased for me by my best friend, Aaron Sparrow, because he cares about me and he knows I haven't been in a position to buy myself toys, and he knows that I love toys and he loves to see me happy
with the toys. So as he finds things and gets things, he hands them to me. I mean, that's the generous man that I met that day at the San Diego Comic-Con and who I've been friends with ever since. So shout out to Aaron Sparrow. It makes me want to cry. You're such a good friend, my friend. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And working with Aaron on Toy Story was a dream. We kicked ass on that book. The first arc in particular is really awesome. And then we started to run into some trouble. Licensing comics, it's you pay a certain amount to the company, and then they give you permission to go out and make comic books. And then you have to, I mean, there's all different deals that can be made. But at the end of the day, you have to listen to the feedback of the parent company that you have licensed these things from. In the case of the Muppets, we were having to listen to the Disney people and their notes, and the Muppet people and their notes, and I think an additional person who was in there. Pixar, we had to listen to the Disney people and the Pixar people. When it was just Disney, it was usually like one level of scrutiny. But suffice to say, there was a lot of eyes looking at your book before it came out. And these eyes were the eyes of lawyers and the eyes of managers at the company who wanted to keep their jobs. And them wanting to be safe became a thing. And we did a couple things in our first issue that got us in trouble. And well, not our first issue, in like our first four issues that got us in trouble. One of the main things that we did was we included a character named Booster, who was a part of the short-lived Buzz Lightyear animated series that had been made. Well, little did we know, or the people who we were working with at the time, but John Lasseter apparently hated that series. And eventually somebody saw our book after it had been published and they went, what? You used characters from that series? John Lasseter hates that stuff and he's the current head of Disney. If he sees this, he's not going to like it. So that got a little bit more eyes on our book. We also did something in issue 3 that caused us a lot of problems, or actually it was issue 2, because, oh, I should go back a second. One of the first stupid things about this series was I wrote a number one issue. I wasn't told that Toy Story was being put out as a zero issue first. So my first issue, which came out on Free Comic Book Day like 8 years ago or whatever, was also released not just as the free comic book, but as a zero issue for Toy Story. But it wasn't a zero issue. It was a issue one. I could have written a zero issue, but I didn't. Later, when they turned my ongoing series into a series of miniseries, and we did a series called Toy Story Toy Overboard, I thought that they were going to do the same thing that they had been doing, this zero issue thing, and I wrote a zero issue. But this time, sure enough, they put it out as a number one. So now the zero issue that I wrote was a number one, and the number one issue that I first wrote came out as a zero issue. So that wasn't great in terms of people reviewing the book and checking out the book. It certainly didn't help our cause. But generally speaking, our book was really well received. But after issue 2, we had a special appearance from Mr. Potato Head dressing up as Spud Lightyear. He basically gets all of his pieces removed, and then there's this great moment where we make a reference to the Million Dollar Man, and some Mr. Potato Heads and Doctor outfits come out, and they're like, we can rebuild him. We have the technology. And then a couple pages later, you turn the page, and Spud Lightyear reveals himself and gets into the fray. Well, when the legal department saw that we had made Spud Lightyear, they freaked out. Because apparently it was contractual that any depiction that Disney made of the Mr. Potato character in Toy Story could be made into a toy by the company that owned Mr. Potato Head. So the moment we made Spud Lightyear, it was fair game for them to produce a Spud Lightyear Mr. Potato Head. And theoretically speaking, you know, Disney would want extra money for that. As it actually turned out, there was already a Spud Lightyear in production as a toy that we didn't know about and they didn't know about because they didn't even bother looking into it, as most of these people don't do. Most of the people who are assigned to do these jobs, they just play it safe. They don't investigate. They don't go to their higher-ups and ask their boss if it's possible or can we do that. Well, can you ask? Nah, I'd rather not ask. I don't want to piss anybody off. I don't want to rock the boat. Most people don't.
I like to rock the boat. But of course, we wouldn't find this out for like another 6 months or so when we would see it offered in catalogs and go, what the hell? So we had to retroactively rewrite the third issue and change a ton of art for the third issue before it came out. And if you read the original physical copies of issue 2 to issue 3, you'll be like, what the hell happened? In the graphic novel collection of this book, you'll see it all together and it's right. Granted, there's no Spud Lightyear because we had to remove that. But it was a big deal at the time. And after I finished that first arc, we were 2 issues into our next arc, which was a great one. It was called Toy versus Machine. And it was essentially John Henry versus the steam engine as a metaphor for the toys versus video games, which are basically making Andy a zombie obsessed with video games and no longer playing with his toys. The basic story was there's a Buzz Lightyear video game and Zurg is the bad guy and Zurg is in the television and he's using the Nintendo, you know, or whatever it is, the game system to attack the toys. It was awesome. It was one of my favorite things that I'd ever conceived of and started writing. I was 2 issues into it and I had to stop. I got paid for those 2 issues, which was nice, but I had to stop and go back to the drawing board and start again using a pre-approved book that was written for children. They said, have him adapt these stories. And I was handed this terrible, terrible Toy Story book that had been put out at the time that was featured a whole bunch of short stories featuring the Toy Story characters, and I was told to adapt any of those stories that I wanted into the book. But they were legit terrible. It was for children. There was nothing interesting or exciting about any of these stories. They were just generic and really boring. Which for me defeated the whole purpose of Pixar, which everything Pixar put out was this elevated thing that an entire family could enjoy, the old and the young alike would all come away happy with their experience with a Pixar film. And I wanted our comic books to be as great as the Pixar films, to stand alongside them. But this, what I was being asked to do, was just to write a book for children. And I don't do that. I write stories for everybody. So I adapted some of the stories. They're not my favorite. They're good. I'm good at writing character dialogue. I've got a pretty good ear for music and the way people speak. It's just music. And so if I can listen to somebody long enough, I can kind of hear the way they sing, you know, the way they speak. And I can replicate it. I can replicate it with my voice. I'm a voiceover actor, so I can sit there and I can do some John Lovitz or, hey, cowgirl, see the grass? Don't eat it. Anybody that I like, if I spend enough time listening to them, I can go and I can regurgitate what they're doing. And easily, I can do that as a writer, even for people who I can't speak like them. You know, I might not be able to do a great impression verbally, but I can do a great impression on the page. So the books are good, but they're not great. And the first story arc that we wrote was great. It was really great. Even after that change to Spud Lightyear, it was a great story. Most Toy Story fans will agree. We've always had really good reviews of that book when you find it online. But the story afterwards, it was a real markdown. And even the next story that I did, you know, we relaunched it. And the first book took place between Toy Story 1 and Toy Story 2. The second series that I did, the little mini series of Toy Overboard, that took place in between Toy Story 2 and Toy Story 3. So we had to introduce Jesse. And I introduced Jesse in a Zero issue, because I thought it was going to be a Zero issue. But this whole story of Toy Overboard, it was the weakest, most simple, pedestrian story that I pitched them. I had great stories. I had a great one called Day of the Living Clay about Play-Doh, who like used some of Mr. Potato Head's parts from Andy. Andy makes like a clay man out of Mr. Potato Head's parts, and he comes to life and is deranged, and he starts making an army of these clay zombies. Anyway, for various reasons, these pitches and different things were rejected. And I'll tell you what, man, when Toy Story 3 came out, me and Aaron were so pissed off because there's so many things that they did in that movie that we were trying to do in the comic. And they kept telling us no, because they didn't understand the movies and the characters and all of the rules and the world that was being built the way we did. I had this great joke in the book, and I don't remember exactly what it was now, but it was something about the claw. The three aliens were talking about how they were obsessed with the claw. And the lady goes, they aren't obsessed with the claw anymore. And I went, What do you mean they're not obsessed with the claw anymore? I mean, that's like their one defining characteristic, is that they're obsessed with the claw. And sure enough, Toy Story 3, the three aliens get into a giant claw machine and use the claw to save all of the toys from the lava machine that's going to melt all the garbage and them into nothing. So me and Aaron were like, just like, man, these idiots, we could have did that in the comic and they stopped us. Stuff like that was happening all the time. We would just be prevented from taking Mr. Potato Head's pieces and putting them onto a piece of food like they did in Toy Story 3. There was tons of things. But I tell you what, when you're dealing with licensed comics, you're dealing with lots of people who aren't creative and they just want to keep their job. And then when you do something that seems new, they go, ah, dangerous, don't want to lose my job. So if you ever read a licensed comic and you go, man, this is just so safe. I wish they were doing something more interesting with these characters. There's so many things that I think that I could do with these characters if I was writing it. Yeah, there are. But will they let you? Will they let you do those things with the characters? Most of the time, no. No, they won't. It sucks. Around this time, I also started working on Muppet Snow White, which started out as the greatest thing I had ever wrote and ended up the worst story of licensing hell, destroying a script that I have in my personal experience. I'm really excited to tell you about it, but it's going to have to wait until, I guess, a third part next week, because I still have a lot to tell you about working in the industry and working for all these companies, and we're getting close to an hour, and I got a fan letter I want to get to. So next time, from Brian Burns, and he wrote to jesseblaze at jessesnyder.com, if you'd like to write too. I need to read the damn books. Seems like you do more than just the homework. No one needs someone who doesn't know what the fuck they are saying. Find someone who studies the source. How have you become such a successful writer, Jesse? Did you start listening to the fans and what they need, or did it take work? There's really more ways than one to go about criticizing and critiquing someone's creation, but you'll be more criticized if you don't study the creation. Your episode has taught me that you take your work very seriously and with so much pride. I love toys too, more than I realized. The Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movies helped me overcome bullies when I was a kid, so I have a special place in my heart for them, and I feel I owe them a great deal of gratitude. It's amazing how movies can affect you. I got my appreciation for movies when I landed a job at Blockbuster after leaving the Army. Hey, I worked at Blockbuster Video too, Brian. Hands down, best job ever. My best jobs were at the comic book store, but Blockbuster Video, close second. As your biggest fan, I admire your love and dedication to the entertainment business / process. You have an incredibly sharp mind, and I believe you are doing the work you were put on this earth to do. Aw, thank you very much, man. Much love and all the respect. I think right now I'll go check out your recommendation and watch Storks. Oh, it's so funny. I think I might be a geek too. Not as cool as you, though, winky smile. Your number one fan, Brian Burns. Aw, man, thank you so much, bro. I really appreciate that. Listening to the fans and what they need, it all takes work. It really takes experience. The best way to do a thing is not to go to college and learn about doing the thing. It's to actually do the thing. I had a class called Independent Writing for Publication. Shout out to Mrs. Krinsky. Everything that I wrote in this class was submitted to a contest of some variety. And I won awards and got honors and all these things. And it helped me build my confidence over time. We all did. Most of the members of the class received some sort of acknowledgement for their work throughout the year. It was amazing. Writing is just communication, and you get better and better and better at communicating. If you're excited and you have a passion, there's probably a reason why you have excitement and you have passion. If you can figure out how to properly explain that excitement and that passion to people, you are now a writer, a successful writer. When you're dealing with your mom and your dad, you'll see that maybe you don't get the best results when you talk to them a certain way. And then you have to adjust over time how you talk to them. And if you do a good enough job, you'll get better and better at communicating with your parents. And before you know it, your relationship with them is better. Or your relationship with a friend is better because you've gotten better at your communication skills. Communication is the greatest skill you can learn. And it just takes practice and paying attention to the fans or paying attention to the people you're talking to and people's reactions and how you're being perceived and whatnot. And you can improve your communication over time. And that's it. You want to be a writer? Just start writing things. Write poems, make rhymes, write songs, anything. You want to write? Write things. Write things that make you happy. Write and write and write and write. And then when you got something and you feel like you're doing okay,
send it off. Send it to a friend. Say, hey, how is this? Is this good? Do you like this? And see what kind of feedback you get back. And try not to take that feedback to heart and just, you know, take it in and adjust your communicating and try again and keep going. I am a testament to the work that I did yesterday. We tend to be our own worst critics and our own worst enemy and get in our own way. So don't be afraid. Just do it, and do it from a place of love and a place of passion. And I promise you, you will succeed if you don't give up. That's the one common thing all successful people have. They never gave up. Anyway, this concludes this week's episode of The Coolest Geek Alive. I'm going to continue the story of my journey through comic books and multimedia next week with a ton more different properties from Archie and Puss in Boots and Casper and Fraggles and Sesame Street, and then independent comic books like my King of Kings, which is live on Kickstarter right now. We need you. We need your money. We need your support. Get your butt over to the Kickstarter website and please pick up a package and help us bring this book to life. It's not just this book. It's the whole series. It's not just this whole series. It's the books that I'm going to do in the future. I have so much love and wonder to offer to you as an audience. Please, if you help me, I will make sure that you are smiling and laughing for the rest of your life. Thank you so much for joining me today on The Coolest Geek Alive. Write me at jesseblaze@jessesnyder.com if you got anything to say about this one. And join me next time on another fabulous episode of The Coolest Geek Alive! You've been listening to Coolest Geek Alive with me, your host, Jesse Blaze Snyder.
Isn't that heavy?
Don't forget to rate, comment, and subscribe for more excellent geek culture content. Thanks for listening.
It's gonna be freaking awesome. Coolest alive. It's gonna be freaking awesome. Stay with your tribe. It's gonna be freaking awesome. Revenge of the Geeks. It's gonna be freaking awesome. Week after weeks. It's gonna be freaking awesome. Laughing with you. It's gonna be freaking awesome. And crying sometimes too. It's gonna be freaking awesome. Spilling it out. It's gonna be freaking awesome. Making you shout.
I'm a genius. I got lyrics coming out me bum for days. You like that? It's a kazoo solo.
It's gonna be freaking awesome.
Talking some shit.
It's gonna be freaking awesome.
Living legit.
It's gonna be freaking awesome.
Food in our mouth.
It's gonna be freaking awesome.
Getting a mouth.
It's gonna be freaking awesome.
Tell all your friends.
It's gonna be freaking awesome.
Draw right our text.
It's gonna be freaking awesome.
Raising the bar.
It's gonna be freaking awesome.
Awesome! Friggin' awesome! It's going to be friggin' awesome! Just wait! You'll see! You'll all see!